This is Bruce Kalk interviewing Mr. Floyd McKissick, May 31st, 1989. Mr. McKissick, to begin with, why don't we delve into a little bit about the your family history and a little bit about your upbringing, if you will.
Well, just what do you want to know about my family history and upbringing? I was born in Asheville, North Carolina, March 9th, 1922, on Ridge Street. Both of my parents were the sons and daughters, respectively, of ministers. So consequently, I had a very good religious influence in my life, and an excellent social life, because in the black community, the church, and all of its programs was in a segregated community, the represented the society in which we lived at that time. I had good parents. Father was Ernest Boyce McKissick. He was originally from South Carolina, Kelton, South Carolina, Union County, and the McKissicks had been on the McKissick plantations down there from slavery all the way on, and the other McKissicks were president, I think, respectively, of the University of South Carolina at one time, the other part of the family. My mother and father met at a Methodist college, Livingston College, in Salisbury, North Carolina, and married. And of course, I am the second child of four children that they had. My father, at that time, mother and father finished what was known as called normal school, would be equivalent to a little more than high school, because at that time high school didn't go very far, and not the 12th grades that you got now, of course. But both mother and father worked hard. Asheville, North Carolina is a tourist town, and my father did hotel work, and also worked for North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company, which was a fledgling company. He was an agent for North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company. And mother was mother could sew. We had a door, a sign on the house, seamstress. She could sew very well and make all kind of clothes, and made my clothes, of which I was real proud of, one of my first suits. She could sew, and she worked at a department store, Bombashay, was a department store in Asheville at one time, and then she went back to school and took a business course, and then went to work for North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company, and she became a cashier clerk, and she worked there until she retired at North Carolina Mutual. My father, on the other hand, worked at North Carolina Mutual, the hotels, and then he later went into the government services there. And I think he, at the time that he died, he was with Veterans Administration, I think, at O'Teen Hospital in Asheville. I don't know how much to tell you about the backgrounds, but I had good parents. There's no way that I can blame anything that any of the children can ever say anything that their parents didn't try to do for them. Our parents did. Can't blame them for anything. They helped us go to school. They pushed us through school. We were taught to sacrifice, to support the family, to go to church, to do what was right and what was wrong. We were punished if we didn't do it. We were raised, I would think that some of my very happy years from my childhood were my family life as a child in Asheville, some of my very, very happy years. So I can't complain about that part of my life. I think the stronger parts of my life were the fact that I was black, which oftentimes interfered with so much of the happiness that I might be enjoying when there's some change would come about to tell you that you were black and not wanted. I think most of my fights as a child came about issues growing out of that.
Mr. McKissick, what year were you born, Mr. McKissick?
March 9th, 1922.
And you said you had three brothers and sisters?
I have three sisters.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wanted to ask you a little bit, if I could, about any formative experiences you had growing up in Asheville that particularly linger, any recollections that particularly linger in your mind?
Oh, yeah. There are many experiences I had. I had good elementary school teachers who taught me all of the basics, and I remember all of them basically now. By name, I can remember all my school teachers who taught me. I think that teachers were more committed in that day. I think some of the better experiences that I had was, I think that I remember quicker than any other experiences is the fact that I was skating, and we had a skating a street on which we skated in Asheville, a very smooth street, South French Broad, at which time I was assigned by my scoutmaster to direct traffic and help the smaller kids. And we were told to get out in an intersection. The scoutmaster had just placed us in the intersection to keep smaller kids from coming through the intersection, and some cops came up and said, get off the street. We didn't have no business being there. And upon trying to explain to them, they proceeded to beat and slap me around a little bit. And I retaliated by throwing a skate.
Were there any other formative experiences before you left Asheville that stick in your mind?
Well, yes, I was associated with NAACP, and we had made a request for Paul Robeson to speak at the Civic Center, and we had to go before the city council to ask for his permission to speak at the city Civic Center in Asheville, or the city auditorium, and that was denied. There were many problems of segregation in the city, which we were regularly fighting every day, as it related to blacks in the southern city, where segregation was prevalent. These incidents arose quite frequently. As a child, we had many instances of my riding on the front of the bus to watch the driver, and then my aunt telling me that I couldn't sit up there. And while she was explaining to me, some big heavy man weighing about 300 pounds told her if she couldn't get me up, he was going to pick me up and throw me to the rear of the bus. And I then got up and went back to the back of the trolley car. I say bus, it was really a trolley car. I actually had trolley cars. This was on Montclair College Road that I remember this. And my aunt picked me up and took me to the back. And she just cried as she sat there with me. And I sort of got the understanding of what things were all about a little later in life, not then. I can remember other incidents of that type also.
When did you leave Asheville? Was that to go to college?
Yes. I went to college at Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia. I went down there in 1939, my first year. And then from there, I think I went to Connecticut for a summer and to own a tobacco farm, worked up there. And then I worked around during the period of time up until the time I got in the Army in '45. I was in and out of school depending upon the amount of money that it took to go to school. At that time, it didn't take but $325 a year to go to school, but that was a lot of money when it came to working and making it then.
I'd like to, if we could, switch our attention to the background of the desegregation case at UNC. Would you be able to tell me a little bit about the earlier efforts to desegregate UNC prior to your own involvement?
I recall my early involvement in the desegregation of North Carolina. We wrote and asked for applications right after I came out of the Army in 45, requesting admission. And I think we never received a reply to our first letter to the University of North Carolina. I was living in Asheville then, and I had a short time before that, there was the Holcutt case, which had been brought to go to the University of North Carolina. Raymond Holcutt, I think it was his name, who had tried to go to North Carolina, and I think that that case was tried in state court and was lost. And he was not permitted to get into the case. My association, when we came to, after we got out of the Army, we were determined that there was not going to be any more segregation in North Carolina. I think most of the fellows who had been in World War II had been around the world and they had seen things, and they knew that they were not what America had depicted them to be. They had seen the whole world, and they were not going to live in a pattern of segregation as they had in the past. And when we came to North Carolina, I went to Morehouse and did another year, and I had 3 years of college under my belt, and I had made the dean's list at Morehouse. The dean's list was what we call an honor roll. I came up to North Carolina Central, and that time it was called North Carolina College for Negroes, or they had just changed it to North Carolina College at Durham. And was admitted to law school, and we immediately decided upon getting the law school accredited. It was unaccredited. Didn't have enough books, didn't have enough space, didn't have enough facilities, and it was called a law department. And we then went to the legislature. Efforts to talk to people didn't prove any avail, so we decided to picket the legislature. That time, newspaper didn't pick up too much of what black people wanted to negotiate, no way. you had to take some action. Only time that they would listen to you was some action. And we decided to picket the legislature. So a group of us picket the legislature. And as a result of picketing the legislature, they decided to expend more money to bring the law school up to accredited levels. We also decided that we needed to bring, with the cooperation of NAACP, bring suit to enter the University of North Carolina.
What was the date on your picketing the legislature in the effort to get North Carolina Central accredited?
Don't recall. I think I can find that written down someplace for you. I don't recall. It's possibly a year before we filed the suit, because talk was going on with maybe they would let somebody in over there, and some quiet talk never proved to be of any benefit. But we did pick it, and we've got some pictures and everything of it for you. At any rate, when we brought the suit, before we brought the suit, I was not the first plaintiff. I think I was about the third in line. That was Harold Epps, and Glass. And that was another person who was in the lawsuit. It ended up, Epps graduated, and someone else stepped down from the suit, and I became the major plaintiff in the suit after that time. Then after I became the major plaintiff, at the time the case was being called for trial, there were interveners, and the interveners were J. Kenneth Lee, Harvey Beach, J. Kenneth Lee, Eugene Lassiter, and possibly four or more others who joined just before the suit started trial in Durham.
Let me interrupt you, if I may. What year was McKissick versus Carmichael initiated? Do you recall?
No, I have to get to records again on that. I get these dates a little confused now. It used to be that I could remember them all the time. I think that was a book put out by the student government of North Carolina that has all those dates and figures in it. And that would be your best bet on that. I think Student Government in North Carolina, written by Albert Coates, has pretty well.
What events in particular prompted you to initiate the suit?
One, we had attempted to, after we got out of the Army, I knew that I was going into law. And during the time that I was in Atlanta, we had written the University of North Carolina and got no reply to asking them. It was generally felt, and there was a feeling in the air that people were going to be fair and treat you right, and you were a returning veteran, and some schools were letting blacks in that never had it before. There were high quotas, and veterans were getting quotas. So that was the feeling in North Carolina. North Carolina would do some of these things without being forced to do it. That feeling was later determined to be a false feeling, false emotions that we had. And after I came to the law school here and I saw the best thing that North Carolina Central had was some good professors, solid professors, who were teaching. And they were really giving you everything that they had. But we didn't have the books. And they used to always say, we do not have these books. We do not have this and that, and you will have to do this. And there was no place for us to go get these things, no place to go, no place to borrow books. We didn't have the reporters that we needed.
If I may, how would you compare the, on the one hand, why you selected University of North Carolina in particular to try to desegregate, and the second part of the question, how University of North Carolina fit into the sort of overall strategy about desegregation, what attitudes of the administration seem to be?
First of all, I had made applications to go to law school to about 7 law schools and had been admitted to Cleveland Western Reserve. I think at that time Fordham Law School had been admitted, but each one had given you a time to come, and you would have been out of school a half a year because the list was so long. Howard University had a long list, all black kids in the country were just about going to Howard, and to get on that list, you'd have to wait 3 years before you could get in school. So it was decided, here's North Carolina right here. We knew that North Carolina Central, the law school there, was not comparable to the University of North Carolina. We had been over there and had seen the University of North Carolina and saw the difference. They didn't know what we were doing over there or anything, but we went over to see the difference, and we made these comparisons. And at that time, the NAACP had done some studies, and we were ready for this suit. And it was just decided that suits were being brought all over, in many states in the South at this time to desegregate the law schools or the professional schools. And we decided that we were going to go ahead and crack the law school and crack it now. It was just, you had top students. We could have got in school anywhere. It was just a matter that we were black in the university. And one of the worst things they were doing was not replying to correspondence or just ignoring it or throwing it away, which had occurred for 2 years in a row. So it was then decided that a suit was the possible way.
Within the strategy of using a lawsuit to desegregate the university, do you remember making any, participating in any discussions about tactics in order to pressure the university to accept black students?
We decided that a law school was going to be the best way. There had been some people that knew, there were some blacks in the community who knew some whites over there. There had been meetings among those groups of black and whites who met together. I think the Southern Conference for Human Welfare at that time, headed by Clark Foreman out of New Orleans. There were other black and white groups who met, Congress of Racial Equality, the NAACP, black and whites, church groups, particularly Charles Jones of Chapel Hill was one of my strong supporters. Certainly supported me, and at a time when I really needed the support, was there with me at the University of North Carolina.
Was he a white man?
Yes, he was a Presbyterian minister, Charles Jones. Yes, he was. I think he's still alive today. And there was another lady, I was trying to think of her name, at the YMCA there, that supported those black kids who were going after we came on the campus. It was not a friendly arrival when we got on the campus by any means.
Let's. I want to take that up in a moment or two, but I want to finish one matter about the lawsuit in particular. Did you initiate it in state or federal courts?
It was initiated in federal courts.
And what was the progress of the case through the federal courts?
Progress was slow, just as courts do today. Progress was moving along. I think that it was during my first year of school, getting some of the years straight. My first year of school was 1949-50 school year at North Carolina Central. And the next year was 49-50, and so consequently, it takes 3 years to go to law school, and the decision came about the same week that I graduated. and receive my degree from North Carolina Central. You see, I had graduated from North Carolina Central Law School.
But you attended University of North Carolina thereafter, is that correct?
Correct. As I was a plaintiff, and Thurgood Marshall was our attorney, and who told me at that time to go to the University of North Carolina because my grades, they were questioning the grades of students, making many questions, and he said, I don't believe that you'll have any difficulty over there at all. I believe your grades are straight, and I believe that you can make the course, because there were rumors that if anybody came over there, they wasn't going to pass, no way, they were going to fail them. And he said, I believe that you can understand it and you can take the pressure and the stress. And that was the reason that I went over, although I had completed my legal requirements at that time. I still went to the university for that summer.
Mm-hmm. And then you just attended the University of North Carolina for that one summer, is that correct?
That's right, mm-hmm. Just for that summer.
What was your experience as the first black student and along with the other first black students at the University of North Carolina?
Well, some of the students did not live on the campus. I was one of the ones that lived on campus in a cubicle up there at Steele Hall, I think it was. And I was also a working student. And I waited tables at a place called the Bartlett House. And working at the Bartlett House out there, I would work in the evenings. My job would start at about 5 o'clock, and it would be over with around about 1 or 2 o'clock at night, and then I'd come in, go to bed, and get up. And so consequently, sometimes I was the only black student on the campus. I was the only black there many a day. And at first, there was an honor system in existence on the campus, and no doors were locked, and I didn't lock my doors. I stayed in a cubicle where the other black students were supposed to stay, and did stay sometime during the daytime. Many of them didn't want to stay at night, so I was alone there, and they would come in, they put a black snake in my drawer, a dead black snake, in my drawer on my shirts. They would put water on your clothes, put a bucket of water over your door to trick you. When you come in, you open the door, a bucket of water would fall because, see, no doors were locked. They would be halfway or partially open. And they had a lot of fun with you. They thought they were having fun. You get a letter every day from the Ku Klux Klan, telling you that you're at the wrong place and what's going to happen to you. You had a lot of threats. I, however, didn't let the threats bother me too much. And when I came in, I'd study, and classes started, I think, at 7:30 or 8 o'clock. I would be in my class, and I'd be ready to go. But in that summer, I think that things were segregated around the campus. I had to establish my right to eat in Steele Hall dining room. That was Lenoir Hall, I think, dining room. Lenoir. And after two or three kids knocked the trays out of my hand, I went through the line one day and made a big announcement that I intend to eat today, and I don't intend to let anybody knock any tray out of my hand anymore. I can't afford it in the first place. And I walked through that line, then nobody say nothing. And I stopped all that. I let them know.
Let me ask you, sir, do you recall any other segregated facilities after the technical desegregation of the university? For example, was seating at the library segregated or anything of that sort?
Never had any trouble seating at the library. There were some instances of some of the kids went to the swimming pool and to swim, and they wouldn't let them in. And I told them this pool was going to get integrated today, and I just went on and jumped into the pool. And after I jumped into the pool, I walked on out, And nobody said anything to me, and I said nothing to anybody else. I said, it's integrated now. And that was it. No one ever said anything to me about it or anything. I got soaking wet, but it was so hot that day that I got dry. But that was about all that occurred on that.
Do you recall any of the students, faculty, or administration who were supportive, besides the people you mentioned, or people who gave you continued support once you arrived there?
The lady is Ann Queen, who was at the Y, who certainly gave us support the whole time. There were a number of students. Don't forget, the pressure was on many of the white students that would try to treat us nice, would call nigger lovers. But there were always a group of whites there who wanted us there and who tried to help us out in many ways. But they were under a great amount of pressure, and some evenings they would come by and talk to me when I got there late at night. Quite often there would be somebody to talk to me, so long as no one was around to harass them. Call them a nigger lover for their associating with me. That was one of the major problems that was going on. Anytime someone would try to befriend you or treat you nice or pick up a book for you, that'd always be a little choir around the holler, nigger lover, nigger lover, nigger lover. And that stopped many of the whites from trying to do anything.
University of North Carolina's had a reputation as being the center of Southern liberalism, and yet the story that you've described very much contradicts some of that reputation. To what extent do you think the university lived up to that appellation as the bastion of Southern liberalism?
Well, I think you had a man like Frank Porter Graham who expressed himself nationally, and there were members on the faculty who had expressed themselves that we knew about. There were always people at the University of North Carolina who disagreed with the policies of segregation, even when I went there before we had arrived. There were people who talked with us and who gave us advice on what to do, how to do, and who was friendly. But the basic, it's a political school, and it was a political process that tied up so many of the minds of those who were there. I would like to think that it was primarily political rather than that went to the academic community. I think the academic community, I'd say at least 50% of the academic community didn't care one way or the other. But I would think that it was basically a political school, and that because it's involved in the politics of North Carolina, it was not going to move any faster than any other process in the state.
Can you recall any other outstanding recollections about your experiences that summer at the University of North Carolina?
I don't know that I can recall any. I do recall that just before we were getting ready to take exams in the course that I was taking, and it was taught by Professor Vogt, who was said to be a German who taught us sales, that about a week before I had been in sales class and had been called upon to speak, answer questions. And I'd always answered pretty correctly. I kept up with my homework even though I was working. And just before we got ready to take the examination, about a week before, one night I came up to my room and a couple of fellows were in the room, and we started talking about sales, and then a couple of more came in. And about the middle of the summer, I think attitudes had changed. It used to be a choir who used to holler nigger lover. During this summer, I think that it was prevalent on a regular basis. But about the end of the summer, it had faded down. And then the kids in my class who came in the room to study with me said, you know, we won't study with you because we think that we can help each other. They had reached that point. And I began to feel much better. I knew then that I certainly had lost a lot of the inferiority complex that I'd had previously had.
How would you say you were able to smooth the way for other black students to attend the university?
I think that when those who were first, I was not the only one. Sure, I was the first one in a sense, but there were others. There were others during this summer session. This was the only session where there were blacks. And with me at that time, I think, was Lasseter taking that class. And there was another class in which another black was in. I think that one, the mess hall, not the mess hall, it was Lenore Dining Hall, had received its first black, and then it was over with. I think they have to go through the first black syndrome. It's a syndrome for white people. Have you ever seen a black eat? They think all kinds of things, and I think all these stereotypes are thrown out the window after they undergo their experience with the first black being associated with them. So I think that those of us who went there first cleared up the minds of whites more than those of blacks. There were few blacks coming in after that. I mean, relatively few were coming in, but the door had been made easy for them to come because they would no longer create the emphasis around. Sometimes you found it difficult to study. It did take people who were really ready to fight who went there first, because they had to make the course and couldn't let things detract from them. And that was enough distraction on the basis of race and what people would say. And some of the authorities didn't try to help you out. And there'd be maybe one professor would be nice and speak, but many of them wouldn't speak for failure to get the peer approval, you see.
Do you recall any outstanding influences on you at University of North Carolina, perhaps a faculty member who had an influence on you?
Having been there only one summer, I think I made a lot of friends around there, faculty members. I think one of the friends I made was Dan Pollitt at the University of North Carolina Law School, my family are tight friends today, Dan Pollitt. And Dan Pollard says, we were both newly married. We both raised our children. Our children grew up basically together. We were in every organization for the protection or promotion of rights, civil rights, in particular First Amendment rights, freedom of speech. Dan and I are the best of friends. Even right now, we share Christmas parties, weddings, and anniversaries. That was one of the best friends I ever had. I met at the University of North Carolina was Dan Pollitt.
When did full scale, perhaps that's the wrong word, when would you say that the beginning of full term black students coming to UNC took place?
It was after I left. I think the number of students in the 60s was certainly the number of students that came in increased dramatically, and it was they only brought in a number of students after they hired blacks to develop a program to bring in more students into the University of North Carolina. And I think when federal funds became available on the basis of a non-discriminatory basis, the university decided that they wanted federal funds, and they decided to recruit more blacks also.
What are your reflections now, looking backward, on the process of desegregation at the University of North Carolina? There have been those who have made the claim that it was a great deal longer in coming than the success in McKissick versus Carmichael?
Well, I think that the university has made progress in many ways. I think it still needs to concentrate on establishing a policy of full integration. It has not established a policy of full integration. I think it's been applying the oil where the squeak was in the wheel. If you don't really holler, nothing is corrected. There has to be pressure brought about before corrections are made. I wish that the universities, I wish that all of the universities, not only UNC, but Duke as well, decided to get more black faculty, persons and administration, and in all levels of the development growth of the university. It would be far more meaningful to blacks than just having black students. And I think they need to go out and recruit and bring in far more black students than they do.
It's been said that the black community in North Carolina was in many regards more accommodating of the white power structure, if you will, or to use another term, white institutions that were relatively more civil or progressive, given the atmosphere in other parts of the South. Do you think that there's truth to that, or do you think that your experience in desegregating the university in particular illustrates another aspect of the black community's resistance?
I think North Carolina has always been able to hide, to a great extent, put forth, is what I should say, rather than hide. I think they put forth a public relations image that they are far more progressive than other southern states. But I think if you look at the record now, you got far more black elected officials in Alabama and Mississippi, and far more legislations to carry out federal programs in Mississippi and Alabama than you have in North Carolina today. And particularly when it comes to economic development towards blacks, Mississippi has passed some special legislation. And Alabama, even under Governor Wallace, had changed its course and actions towards blacks, and it opened up doors for employment. And both of these states would now compare and exceed the numbers in schools, educational and institutions, and in North Carolina, even today.
Have you had any continuing connections or relationships with the University of North Carolina, particularly with the black community at the University of North Carolina?
The Black Student Union has talked to me about every year, and I'm over there at least once a year, and I meet with them, and they talk once in a while about the problems of at the University of North Carolina, and I belong to the Alumni Association, and I keep up with them that way. Other than that, there is no effort to tie me to the University of North Carolina. I thought one time I ought to place an application over there to teach, now that I'm about ready to retire, see if they would offer me a job. See if they are ready to say that, you know, the time has come and we're going to do it.
Would you be able to connect your experiences, your early experiences in McKissick versus Carmichael, with your later career as a civil rights activist in the 1960s?
Well, I think I've always been an activist in the civil rights movement. That's started from the incident where I was beaten by the cops I was telling you about in Asheville, North Carolina. I have been active in demonstrations. I believe in civil disobedience, and I believe that if you believe a law is wrong, and then you disobey that law and you pay the consequences for it. And I believe that you have to resort to demonstrations where you have the lack of response to requests or the lack of communications. There has to be a method of opening the door, so there's no other method except an outward confrontation. And that confrontation has to be had, and has to be had in public in order to bring about change. I still believe that. I still believe that there's a need for direct action in many areas today.
The experience of desegregating University of North Carolina did not take place at the same time as the experience of desegregating the city of Chapel Hill. Did you play any role in that process at all?
Yes, it was the Congress of Racial Equality. I think James Farmer, who was the National Director of CORE at that time, and I was the chairman of the board of CORE, which was called the National Action Committee. We both participated in the demonstrations in Chapel Hill. We had a strong chapter of CORE in Chapel Hill, in the city, and a strong chapter in Durham, and they both we both made a demand upon the city of Chapel Hill that they should desegregate by a certain date, which they didn't do. And if they didn't do, we were going to have massive demonstrations, and that we did. And eventually it came about.
I want to end our interview by asking you if you have any other recollections or comments about the experiences that you had in Chapel Hill or in connection with the university, or any parting comments that you have about your feelings now about the University of North Carolina.
I think that I'm associated with the University of North Carolina through the city regional planning school. I think my son went to school over there. My daughter went to school. My daughter went to undergraduate school at Carolina, and my son went to the School of Planning and got his master's degree, and I've met a number of the professors over there who were closely associated with me in the development of Soul City, and one or two of the law professors over there that are friends. I see the university as a great thing. I think it's able to do far more than it does, though. It has a great amount of power, but it doesn't seem to use its power to bring about the change just that can be made, or to tie the town and gown together. On the other hand, there are individuals, and there have always been a number of individuals, professors, who have always championed the cause of blacks or minorities or the underprivileged. And the university still has that spark in it, which I love to support whenever I see that those sparks coming in from the students or from the professors over there. Every liberal movement, I think, in the state of North Carolina has been associated. There have been professors from the University of North Carolina associated with it. And I'm talking about white professors who have been associated with it. So there is, it could do, the university could do a lot more than what it's doing, though.
Thank you.